This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we will visit with Chris Nelson of the Gulf Coast Seafood Coalition. Some items of importance going on right now in Baton Rouge, particularly at the state capital. And of course, this is an industry that was affected immensely by the tragedy of 3 years ago with the Deepwater Horizon. Also on the show, Tom Aswell of Louisiana Voice on what is happening at the Capitol today. There will be a vote, it seems, on Medicaid expansion in committee, and there is much scuttlebutt about what will happen at the Capitol, and we'll review it with Tom Aswell. And Victoria Sweet, she is a doctor who has been at San Francisco's Laguna Honda Hospital for more than 20 years. This is one of the most profound hospitals in America. We'll find out why. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Good morning. Your number is 297-5633 locally. And if you're dialing outside the Baton Rouge calling area, 877-217-5757. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. We start with Chris Nelson. He is chairman of the Gulf Coast Seafood Coalition, and he's a busy man, and it's been 3 years since the Deepwater Horizon tragedy. And Chris, you're not only head of this coalition, you're a practitioner in the industry. How's it going right now?
Oh, we're doing okay. Hanging in there.
How were you affected by what happened 3 years ago?
Oh, it was pretty traumatic to see our source for our livelihood potentially go away. I guess I would put it that way. It was a very crystallizing moment for everyone in the industry to have to do a gut check and potentially look at the Gulf of Mexico and wonder what we will do without it if potentially they can't get the oil turned off. But thank goodness our prayers were answered and they did get it turned off, and the environment seems to have recovered much better than some of the worst predictions were.
Your company is based in Alabama, isn't it?
It is.
Okay. Now, the Gulf Coast Seafood Coalition not only includes Louisiana, but several other states, including Alabama, Texas, Mississippi, and Florida, right?
Correct. The Gulf Seafood Marketing Coalition, it is really a platform that was the brainchild of my good friend Mike Boisan, who recently passed away. He and I spoke really in the early days following the oil spill. I can't remember if they had the oil controlled at that point or not, but we began to see all the news media coverage of the environmental damage that was going on and the potential for contamination. And therefore, we knew that there would be a number of questions, a lot of scrutiny of our products, and that potentially we had some rebranding and marketing to do post-event for some time. And so Mike had the idea that we should marshal the forces of all of the five Gulf states, because everybody that touched the Gulf was going to be affected. Anybody that had Gulf in their name was going to be affected, and we were members. He was chairman at the time, and I've been a member of the Gulf and South Atlantic Fisheries Foundation for years, and they have the ability to receive funds and create programs on behalf of the seafood industry. So we approached that group about being prepared to create some sort of a marketing coalition on behalf of the five Gulf states, because Florida had a seafood marketing program. Louisiana, of course, had the largest and best established one with the Seafood Promotion and Marketing Board. Texas has a small effort, really mostly on behalf of shrimp. And Mississippi has a program, and Alabama did not. And luckily, in fairly short order, we were able to create a seafood marketing commission here in Alabama. But in any case, as a result of Mike's leadership on that foundation, we got money from the Gulf States Marine Fisheries Commission that was given to them by Congress, And that money was transferred to the foundation in the form of a grant, and we hired a very experienced marketing individual that had worked in Florida, and she put together on our behalf a very, I think, what's been a very effective platform for the states to work together.
All right. Well,
rather than in competition to help us recover from a seafood consumer standpoint.
Now, a few days ago, you sent a letter to Governor Jindal.
Correct.
What is this about?
Well, I was made aware of some efforts over in your state that potentially the legislative initiatives that would take away or change, would take away some of the autonomy or a good bit of the autonomy of the board, the Seafood Promotion and Marketing Board, and the other one would transfer it to a different agency. I don't know what all the ramifications of that one would be. I've looked at the bills. I'm not a legislator. I'm not a lawmaker. All I know is it's been working really, really well, and that Seafood Promotion and Marketing Board in Louisiana was our most important partner in this effort. If the Louisiana Seafood Promotion and Marketing Board had not been behind and in full favor of having this coalition and working together with the other four Gulf states, we would not be nearly as far along as we are. And I think our overall effort, I think all the states would agree, our overall effort to recover from the spill would be far less effective.
Now, the Gulf Coast produces about 70% of the nation's oysters, 70% of domestic shrimp. It's a leading producer of domestic hard and soft shell blue crabs, obviously a major industry in this area. And the bill, at least the first one that Chris Nelson of the Gulf Coast Seafood Coalition pointed out, is sponsored by Norby Chabert, Senate Bill 167, would transfer oversight of the board from the Department of Wildlife and Fisheries to the Department of Culture, Recreation, and Tourism, which would move the authority from, or oversight from, the executive branch to the lieutenant governor. Now, what would be particularly wrong with this? I don't know why it would be done, but is there anything particularly sinister about moving it to the office of the lieutenant governor?
I don't know, other than why would the change be proposed now, given the criticality of the operations moving forward sort of unimpeded. We've got a tremendous amount of momentum with the coalition, working with the State Seafood Board. I just would hate to see our most important partner suddenly go through tremendous turmoil being transferred over to a different state agency. I mean, I can't imagine that wouldn't distract them from their most important task at hand, which is helping the seafood industry, ultimately Gulf-wide. And then, I don't see how it could help. So, my perspective of government is similar to the way doctors, I think, approach their task, is first to do no harm. And I don't see how these are going to help. And so, what would be the purpose of doing this is really rather the question I would ask is, how is this going to help things? How is this going to improve the situation rather than why not? I mean, if government went about doing things from a why not standpoint, I think we'd be in a bit of trouble.
Right. You sent your letter to Governor Jindal on April 9th. And you closed by saying, "I'm respectfully requesting your support for the Gulf seafood community and ask that you oppose efforts to substantially change the Louisiana Seafood Board and as it is currently structured. Now, have you received a response? That's been 15 days. Has the governor responded?
No, I haven't gotten any response.
Does that surprise you?
No, I'm sure the governor's busy. I'm sure he got a lot on his plate, including this.
Well, the governor has a large staff that could respond to you.
Well, that's certainly true. I would expect at some point in the next week or so that I'll get at least an email acknowledgement of receipt. But I think in many cases, things like this, particularly since I'm from out of state, they may or may not respond directly to me, but maybe respond to members of the seafood industry inside the state that are also members of our coalition.
So as far as the industry right now, as we are currently situated 3 years post Deepwater Horizon, how is it right now?
We're, you know, actually I think we're quite fortunate to be as well situated as we are. Production of shrimp seems to be good. I think we're hopeful for a good season, although it's been particularly cool this spring. So we're a little bit of anxiety on what that's going to do to the shrimp crop. The oyster crop is probably the most troublesome. It doesn't seem to have come back as strong as many of us, particularly our company here, is so dependent upon Louisiana as a source of oysters. We'd love to see a more abundant crop of oysters available, but overall, we're slowly digging ourselves out of a very deep hole, and I think we're beginning to get back at least to where we were, where we can see getting back to where we were pre-spill, but our objective is to get better than we were prior to the spill. That was the initial promise from the Obama administration, is that we're going to make the Gulf Coast better than it was pre-spill. And we're
all right. I do have a question I want to pose to you, maybe a couple if we can have time, Chris. Leonard Joseph writes, marketing is product, price, place, and promotion. Note, promotion is only one part. What are you doing as head of the coalition to improve and guarantee seafood from the Gulf as far as the quality? What are you doing?
What is the coalition doing?
Correct.
Well, one initiative that we're looking at is sustainability certifications. I don't know if this speaks directly to the question, but that's one initiative that the coalition is considering. There are a lot of different programs out there to answer consumer concerns about, is the source of this particular seafood item that I'm getting ready to eat, is it sustainable? Is it environmentally sustainable? And, of course, from an industry standpoint, we're interested in that, because if it's something that's not, if the fish stock is not sustainable environmentally, then it won't be economically sustainable either. And that's one aspect of what we're looking at. We're also looking at traceability programs so that we can ensure that if we're marketing, for instance, Gulf shrimp, that, in fact, when you're ordering that shrimp and it comes to you fried or otherwise, where you can't necessarily do, even if you were a scientist, you wouldn't be able to do a species identification, that you could have some assurance that, in fact, it is Gulf shrimp and it's not been substituted. There hasn't been some, a overseas source substituted in this particular case. All that's important for the efforts to be effective, we feel.
Now, the second bill that you noted, 184, Senate bill filed by Gerald Long, would transfer the authority of the board to the Secretary of Wildlife and Fisheries, thereby making the board simply advisory.
Correct.
In nature. So you're against that and against the other one by Senator Chabert, and we'll see where it goes, but obviously it is an important thing, not only for the Seafood Promotion and Marketing Board, but for the industry as a whole. And you can follow the progress of the legislation and, of course, find out much more about seafood on the Gulf by going to eatgulfseafood.com, one word, eatgulfseafood.com. The people in the industry, they're not only folks like you who own businesses. There are many commercial fishermen, processors, wholesalers, you name it, of course, restaurants, retailers, chefs, charter boat sectors. It's a broad business segment, isn't it?
It absolutely is, and that's been one of the most rewarding aspects of the coalition, as well as I think what's made us effective, is we've tried to represent all those sectors. We have a member on the coalition that's from the charter boat for hire fishery, recreational fishery. We've got representatives from the tourism community. And all those were affected just as we were in the seafood community. And what we're finding is how interconnected we all were to
We've got to roll, Chris, but thank you so much. Good luck to you, and let's talk again. Chris Nelson.
Thanks.
My pleasure. Jim. Take care. See you soon. We'll be back. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. And we're joined by one of the most controversial men at the Capitol, Tom Aswell, who is a journalist of long standing and is a man of diverse interests. His book, Louisiana Rocks, The True Genesis of Rock and Roll, remains one of the definitive books about music in our state. And of course, this is a time in which we're celebrating music amid all the chaos at the Capitol. Is it chaotic down there right now, Tom Aswell?
Pretty much.
And Tom's work, as far as covering the Capitol, can be found at Louisiana Voice, Politics at its Worst, as you call it. Why is it chaotic, and why is it politics at its worst?
Well, I think politics at its worst is just a catchphrase. People have long identified Louisiana politics as being very colorful and very controversial and at times very corrupt. So I just thought that was a fitting subtitle for the webpage. As to why it's chaotic, well, the session is not going as planned by Governor Jindal. His tax proposals have fallen by the wayside. Several other of his projects right now are in jeopardy. So I just feel like and the mood at the legislature of the legislators, I'm sorry, is not as pliant as it was in past sessions, because he is a lame duck governor and his poll numbers have gone down and they can read the numbers, and consequently some of them have found lost courage and they're standing up to him like the Board of Regents did recently.
Well, today the House and Senate Health Committees will take up legislation filed by various lawmakers, Democrats, I think exclusively, that would require state participation in the Medicaid expansion. Now, Democrats are a minority in both houses. U.S. Senator Mary Landrieu, Democrat, has written letters to committee members urging support of the expansion. Yesterday, Governor Jindal again stated that he is against it, that he will not change his mind. He called an analysis that the state would save about $500 million by taking the federal Medicaid money. That's $500 million. He called those estimates wrong. He said too conservative. I think he meant too liberal, actually. But do you think the governor has made his case enough that the Republicans will fall in line and back him on this one?
It's hard to say. There is some Republican support for the Medicaid expansion, and as to whether the numbers are there, I just don't know.
Well, they backed the governor on the cigarette tax. You know, he was for it and he was against it. And ultimately, lawmakers sided with him.
Well, if he was for it and against it, how do they know they sided with him?
Well, he was for it on the condition. I don't think he's been inconsistent.
For it before he was against it.
Well, if you were running against him, you could have a field day with that. But we know he was for it as long as it was balanced with a swap for the income tax. So I understand his position, but... But we're still significantly behind taxes on cigarettes in neighboring states. We're $4 behind New York State. But the biggest business proposition in this state that would probably work very quickly is to open a tobacco shop on the borders.
Probably so.
So, Tom, you're from Ruston. You're not too far from Junction City. Are you going to go up to the border and... set up shop?
No, as a non-smoker, I think it would be pretty hypocritical.
Well, I know some non-smokers who have done very well in that
perhaps,
industry.
Yeah,
that's not...
There are teetotalers that run bars, I guess.
297-5633 for the always topical Tom Aswell, who also runs Capital News Service. Last time you were on this show, you said you'd had some opposition from the administration regarding your credentials as a legitimate journalist. Has that changed?
I think they still don't think I'm legitimate. But that's, you know, that's their call if that's what they want. I think my credentials will pretty much stack up. And I'll put them up against theirs anytime. So.
Well, or do you have impediments when you try to cover stories?
Yeah. There is preferential treatment. For example, the Education Department releases documents to favored journalists and withhold them from people like me and the Independent and Lafayette.
So, and why do you think that's the case?
Well, from the emails I did obtain from the Education Department, it's pretty obvious that they have a report at the Times-Picayune that's in their favor, and they leaked these documents to them, but they don't give them to me or to the Independent. And that's backed up by the emails that I have obtained.
What are you going to do about it, if anything?
I have a lawsuit that's waiting to be filed against the Department of Education. I have an attorney who has volunteered his services, believe it or not, free of charge, because he's pretty indignant about the way things have been handled. And
who's your attorney?
I'd rather not say at this point, because when the suit's filed...
You're withholding information.
Well, Tom. Okay, all right. Then in that case, it's Carl Koch.
Carl Koch.
Yeah.
A good attorney.
Yep.
Know him well.
Yep.
So you've got a high-powered lawyer there representing you. You're serious about this.
Yes, I am. I'm very serious. And the Division of Administration as well. Because they're also dragging their feet on. For example, last Monday they tried to tell me they had 3 days to provide information to me when I showed up at their door to get it. And that's not the law. The only reference to 3 days is that the information is not available. They have 3 days to notify me in writing why it's not available and when it will be available. That's the only reference to 3 days in the public records law.
Well, last week four former governors gathered at LSU and talked, and Kathleen Blanco, the former governor, most recent to Bobby Jindal, said she thought for sure that the governor would end up taking the Medicaid money. Doesn't look like he's going to change his mind on this.
No, it doesn't. He's a very stubborn man, and sometimes I think he doesn't read the polls.
Well, should he read the polls?
Yes, he should. I think any politician should. Because that's a reflection of what the people think, and he's elected to represent the people. I think he certainly should read the polls.
Well, at one time, as we know, polls indicated that segregation was a very good thing, that slavery was a very good thing. Sometimes you've got to be ahead of the pack on
these. Point taken.
The governor thinks he's ahead of the pack. He may be wrong, but I think he's sincere.
Yeah. Well, there's no doubt he's sincere. He thinks he's right.
So how can he make his case that he's right and most of the rest of us are wrong?
I don't know. I think you turn that question around. How can we make the case that there are 400,000 people that need health care in this state that don't have it available? I think that's the more important question.
Well, the governor has very few surrogates on this subject right now, and that may be one of his problems, is that there are many people out there, all these think tanks and good government groups are on the other side, with the one exception being the group in New Orleans led by Kevin Kane. I'm sure you're familiar with them, the Pelican Institute. Mm-hmm. They are in accord with the governor. But it would seem that this issue is not going to go away. Even if the vote goes his way today, people are still going to be engaged on this. There's a lot of money on the table.
There's a lot at stake.
Does the governor have his numbers right as far as saying that ultimately it will cost the state more than it will bring our state?
Well, there was some figures released just this week that showed that we would, you mentioned the $500 million. I trust those figures more than I do the governor. These people are professionals. They're actuaries, and they know what they're doing. And I trust their figures more than I do the governor. The governor's figures are politically driven. Maybe the others are to an extent, but I don't think to the same degree.
Well, yesterday, Medicaid expansion proponents, those in favor, held a noon rally on the steps of the Capitol to encourage our governor to begin formal negotiations around the terms by which Louisiana would participate. In joining the gathering included Republican Fred Mills from St. Martinville and a conservative Democrat, Ben Nevers from Bogalusa. So the governor will have some challenges keeping the Republican coalition together, but ultimately it comes down to what these committees do. And if they kill it in committee, it's going to be tough to get this restarted, isn't it?
Yeah, it will be. There's another voice that's a proponent of it. Now, he wasn't at the rally, but he was at the press club, Mr. Bernhardt. He's certainly in favor of the Medicaid expansion, and I think he's a very influential voice that probably should be listened to.
Well, he's definitely passionate about this, and he's a man who knows a budget when he sees one.
Yes, he does.
And the governor, who has this great affinity for the private sector, he has very few advisors from the private sector. He's not from the private sector. He does have Tim Barfield, who used to work for Jim Bernhardt, but it might help if the governor sat down with Mr. Bernhardt. Maybe he could convince Jim that he's right, and maybe Jim could convince the governor that there's a better way to do this. Now, the governor in Arkansas, Mike Beebe, he split the baby and worked mm-hmm. with a Republican legislature and got a compromise that's been embraced by the Obama administration.
Correct.
Could something like that happen?
Correct. And politics is the art of compromise. That's a cliche, but it's also a true one. So, there's nothing wrong with sitting down and discussing it and having a middle ground.
What about Chris Christie, the governor of New Jersey, who relented? He at first was as steadfastly against this as Governor Jindal, but ultimately he decided, I think I want that money.
Yeah, I think he's a pragmatic man.
Okay. 297-5633, if you'd like to join us in our remaining time with Tom as well. His website is Louisiana Voice, Politics at its Worst. Yesterday, the House backed some gun bills. The first measure, House Bill 5, would prevent the federal government from enforcing any law in Louisiana restricting the possession of semi-automatic firearms. It only got 25 nay votes, 67 yays. Another one, House Bill 8, makes it illegal for a person, agency, or entity to make public any information such as names and addresses about concealed weapons permit holders or applicants. That one was passed 76-18. We have a pro-gun legislature.
Insane. Absolutely insane. I have a high school classmate of Mississippi that fits into that mold, and he sends me the emails all the time. And I emailed him yesterday, and I said, you know, if this comes down to your grandchildren being assaulted by some nutcase on a school campus, is that going to change your viewpoint? That's the question I want to put to all of these people. Let's make it a personal issue and see how you feel about it at that point.
Well, you're a guy from Ruston. I'm sure you've hunted.
One time in my life. I'm not a hunter. I hunted one time and hated it. I'm not a hunter.
Well, you're like Rod Dreher, who was with us 2 days ago. He said he was an avid indoorsman. but you're from hunting country, no doubt about that. A lot of your friends and colleagues, I'm sure.
My passion is baseball and tennis, not hunting.
Well, those are good passions to have. But Louisiana is the sportsman's paradise, and hunting generally is considered part of that paradise. And it's hard to get past the cultural affinity for hunting that is present. And this is an issue.
Well, my question, Jim, is why do you need an assault rifle for hunting?
Well, I don't know. I don't know that at all. But some people believe you need an assault weapon. Woody Jenkins being one, he said you need one in case there's a home invasion.
How many times can you kill a person?
Well,
if you can't effectively hit your target in 20 rounds, then you
don't
need
a weapon.
What if
the other guy has an assault weapon?
Well, as I said, if you can't hit your weapon in 20 rounds, you don't need a weapon. You need something else. Stronger locks.
All right. Well, Lewis Unglesby was on this show. I thought he made a persuasive case that that assault weapons are not necessary, and he is an avid hunter. But only 25 lawmakers voted your way and Unglesby's way yesterday. Do you think this is really a case in which they believe this, or are they just scared as you know what to vote the other way?
I think the NRA has their number. I think you're right on the latter point. They are scared. I don't think they're necessarily that passionate about right to bear arms, especially assault weapons. I think it's the NRA.
Mm-hmm. I still see those bumper stickers occasionally. I believe in the right to arm bears.
Yeah.
Well, Mary Landrieu last week in the U.S. Senate made a vote on a gun measure that could come back to be an issue next year. Bill Cassidy,
I'm sure it will.
Her opponent, is out there defending gun rights from his home on Dalrymple Drive. He's on one side, she's on another. Will this be one of the two or three major issues in Senate campaign?
I'm sure it will, and I wonder how many gun victims Dr. Cassidy has performed surgery on.
Well, he's a liver doctor, so I don't know that he does that sort of thing, but he worked at Earl K. Long Hospital.
Correct.
And he's another man. We've had him on this show. He's steadfastly against Obamacare, but he is a man who has spent his career working at a public hospital.
Again, he's reading the numbers, I think, or he thinks he's reading the numbers, although I don't know.
Okay. Well, you're saying, I think, that many politicians are insincere. Who's the most sincere politician in Louisiana right now?
Right now? Whew. Well, this may be open to debate, obviously, but I like Rogers Pope in the legislature out in Livingston Parish. He's a Republican, but he has voted against Jindal on a number of occasions and suffered the consequences. And that takes a little courage, and the man has stood up for education. I think he's a very prestigious man, mm-hmm. very honest.
The governor has been criticized on occasion for playing, quote, hardball, punishing his enemies, rewarding his friends for how they vote. There's nothing particularly new about that.
No, not
at
all. Not at all.
I saw the other day he appointed State Representative Steve Carter to a board. There's an example of a man who has been with the governor every step of the way and is being rewarded for doing so.
Yep. That's the spoil system hard at work. It's always been the way in this country.
But why are we holding Governor Jindal to this standard, saying that's a terrible thing to do?
Because Governor Jindal came into office saying it wasn't going to be that way. That's exactly why. He said this is going to be an honest administration. He's going to pick the best person for the job, not the one who gives the money. And he lied. That's exactly why.
Okay. what was it? Earl Long said, "I lied, so what?"
Yeah, well, that's what
get
he told
over
the,
it.
That's what he told the theater owners. He'd tell them I lied, yeah.
Some would say by nature politicians lie. That's what they do.
Yep.
But this governor, I do recall January 14th, 2008, when he took the oath of office, his first salvo was saying it was a new day, the gold standard for ethics. And many of us believed him, and in some ways I think he's kept his word, but in others he's probably fudged a bit.
I think he's fudged a lot.
So where does he go from here? He can't run for re-election as governor. He could run for the U.S. Senate now or a few years from now, or he could run for president of the United States.
Or he could be a dishwasher for Piccadilly. I don't know. I don't know what he's going to do. I suspect what he's going to do, he's going to take some position in the Republican Party.
Now, what would be wrong with being wrong with being a dishwasher at Piccadilly? noble work.
That's the problem. He's never worked.
He never worked like that.
Correct.
He's worked with his mind.
Right.
But he probably hasn't done that sort of thing.
Right.
And some would say that would be unusual for a governor to go into that line of work.
Well, yeah, I was being facetious, but he has never done physical
All
labor.
Right, don't go away. We'll be back. Tom Aswell for a few more moments, 297-5633. Back after this 90-second pause on WRKF. This is Jim Engster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633. Tom Aswell with us for a few more minutes, and if you'd like to join the conversation via email, inkstershow@wrkf.org works as well. Dominic in Grand Coteau. Good morning, Dominic. You're on the air with Tom.
Good morning, gentlemen. Hey, I've been in heated discussion with friends about the gun laws, and one thing I try to tell them is, like, you know, just stop making them. And they're like, well, the criminals have them. And I say, well, why hasn't somebody stepped up with an automatic weapon to take out the criminal? But the whole idea, though, is like the Iran prevented them from getting nuclear weapons. It's preventative measures, what I try to tell them, so they don't fall into the wrong hands. What do you think about that?
Tom?
What was the question again?
He was kind of moving around a bit, but...
Yeah. Preventative methods?
Yep.
I don't see how that's feasible. I mean, how can you, what are you going to do, a gun buyback? And I don't know.
There's some who advocate that.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's been tried in some communities as well, even here. But preventative methods, I don't know. Sounds good in theory, but I don't know how you can make it work. I just a ban on assault weapons and background checks at gun shows. I mean, mm-hmm. I heard on this morning that you can do Al-Qaeda. There are lessons about buying weapons that you can buy them at a gun show, even with a background check, as long as there's no insanity. You can buy a gun easier than you can get on an airline. Mm-hmm. And it's just crazy, the liberal laws we have about gun purchases.
Well, as we sit here in the studio on the 24th day of April 2013, Barbara Streisand's 71st birthday, by the way.
How old?
71.
Wow.
79 for Shirley MacLaine. We're 6 weeks away from the end of the session. 6 weeks from now, do you think we'll have the governor embracing Medicaid expansion, or will we be on the other side of most of the nation on this issue?
If it passes the legislature, I'm sure he'll veto it. I don't think he's going to change his position. I really don't.
So the answer is no,
right.
According to
Correct.
Tom Aswell. Okay. Well, Tom, always a pleasure. Keep up your work, and we'll follow it, and we'll be talking.
Thank you much.
My friend, Tom Aswell. Be safe, by the way. It's a little treacherous out there today. We're joined right now by Dr. Victoria Sweet. She is an associate clinical professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, a prize-winning historian with a Ph.D. in history. She practiced medicine for 20 years at Laguna Honda Hospital in San Francisco. In her recent book, which we're talking about today, God's Hotel, A Doctor, A Hospital, and A Pilgrimage to the Heart of Medicine, she lays out her evidence in stories of her patients and her hospital for some radically new ideas about medicine and healthcare in this country. Good morning, Dr. Sweet.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, first of all, let's get an image of the hospital, the mm-hmm. Laguna Honda Hospital. It's one of the most fascinating places in the United States, the last almshouse in the country, a descendant of the Hotel Dieu that cared for the sick in the Middle Ages. Why is this hospital so different from all the others in the United States?
Well, it is a descendant of the almshouses, which every county used to have an almshouse, actually, but they were all closed in the 1950s, except for San Francisco's almshouse, which was renamed as a hospital, but it's still an almshouse. And an almshouse was the way we used to take care of the sick poor before there was health insurance. So because it never shut down, it retained a lot of the qualities of hospitals really before we had modern medicine. So visually, it's in the middle of San Francisco on 62 acres of land, and looked really when I first got there like a medieval Romanesque monastery. We had 1,200 patients. And because an almshouse was where you would send people, anybody who you didn't know what else to do with, we had a collection of patients there that were absolutely remarkable from a medical point of view because they had every disease known to man, and from a personal point of view, they were the 2 standard deviations from the mean of any patients I ever had. So the tallest and the shortest and the fattest and the thinnest, the nicest and the meanest. So the whole place was really remarkable in that sense, both how it looked, the kind of patients it had, and the kind of staff, and the kind of medicine we practiced.
Well, here in Louisiana, I think we can identify with that perhaps mm-hmm. more closely than
yeah.
Anywhere else. We've had a charity hospital system. The hospital that would be closest to yours, Earl K. Long here in Baton Rouge, closed 9 days ago.
Oh, wow.
The governor is advocating privatizing health care. He is certainly at odds with the president and the current administration in Washington. But what is your take on the need for this kind of a facility?
Great question. Having had the luxury, I found it luxurious, even though it was It was funky, right? It wasn't fancy, but it was there. And because San Francisco still has its free county hospital, free more or less, and a free county almshouse, it meant if you're a doc, you always have a place to send somebody. And one of the most horrible things, if you're a doctor in a hospital and you have a patient who needs more care or has no place to go, you don't know what to do with them, or somebody shows up at your doorstep, if you're in any other place in the country about, you don't have any place to send them. Or if you're working in a hospital, your hospital fills up with people who don't need to be in the hospital because there's no place to send them. So having an almshouse, what I'm calling an almshouse, a big old free place with beds and doctors and nurses and food and gardens and things for people to do, means you always have a place to send people. And I think when you do the math, it's expensive, but it's less expensive than filling up your acute hospitals and having psychotic patients roam the streets and a lot of the things we've been facing with ever since the healthcare economists got involved in healthcare and started trying to make it more efficient back in the 80s.
297-5633, if you'd like to talk with Dr. Victoria Sweet. Her book is God's Hotel, A Doctor, a Hospital, and a Pilgrimage to the Heart of Medicine. You stayed there for 20 years. That's a long commitment, isn't it?
Yeah, especially since when I first got there and looked around and saw that it was like no hospital I'd ever seen, I told the medical director I would come for 2 months.
What kept you there for 20 years?
The patients were fantastic, and gradually I realized that the staff was an amazing group of people. So it was a lovely place to practice medicine, very interesting. And then about halfway through, we got discovered, and the Department of Justice lawyers and the healthcare economists were appalled by the place and began really pushing San Francisco to close it down or build a new modern healthcare facility. And so I kind of got caught by the interest in seeing what was going to happen. You know, I really didn't want to leave until I figured out what was going to happen and what it would be like when it changed. So
Go ahead. You ended up being there for a long time, 20 years, and you practice something that you call slow medicine. What do you mean by this, Dr. Sweet?
Well, because we had these big old-fashioned open wards, and we had no pressure on us, really, to discharge patients before they were ready, I had as much time as I needed with patients. So I had enough time to examine them thoroughly, re-examine them, try different things, take them off medications, get to know them really well. And what I found was they did incredibly well when they had enough time. And I had many patients get discharged who never would have been discharged anyplace else. And I began to think of this as kind of a slow medicine where the doctor has enough time to do a good job, the patient has enough time to heal. And then I think it's actually cost effective. So slow medicine as opposed to fast medicine, in the same way we have the slow food movement as opposed to fast food.
You talk about people you've experienced and those who were beneficiaries of the kind of treatment mm-hmm. that was involved at God's Hotel, the Laguna Honda, one being Maria McCoy. Tell us about her.
Oh, yes. Well, she was exactly the kind of patient you would think would not have anything to get out of anything. She was an alcoholic. She was in her early 50s, and she got transferred to Laguna Honda because she was dying of cirrhosis. So she was yellow, her belly was swollen, and she looked to me like she had 2 or 3 days. But people are quite strong, and when they have enough time, they'll sometimes turn the corner. And two things turned the corner for Mrs. McCoy. First of all, I had been studying pre-modern medicine, and I did a procedure on her that was a very unusual procedure that we don't use anymore, where I took all the fluid out of her belly that had accumulated because her liver was failing. And then instead of just waiting for it to reaccumulate, I used an abdominal binder, which they used to use back in the 20s. And because Laguna Honda was so old-fashioned, we still had an abdominal binder in our central supply so that the fluid didn't reaccumulate, and her whole process began to reverse very slowly. But at the same time, she developed what the psychiatrists call a transference to me, which means that I became a very important figure in her emotional life. And those two things kind of led her out of this critical period in her life, and her cirrhosis began gradually to reverse. And after 6 months, it was essentially gone. Eventually, she was discharged.
Also, a compelling story that you detail is one of a young Polish man, Lev Grins. What about him? What happened to
him?
And
I should say to your listeners, these are all, I've changed the names and the identifying features of these patients, obviously, for confidentiality and privacy reasons. Well, he was one of my first patients where I really learned how important it was when I had a chance to really thoroughly examine a patient. So he'd been at the county hospital for months with acute pancreatitis, also from drinking, I might add, and had had every procedure known to man, and finally he actually had stabilized. They sent him to Laguna Honda. And when I saw him, what shocked me, aside from all the holes in his body, from all the tubes that had kept him alive, was that his tongue was sticking out of his mouth and was huge. And nobody else seemed to notice that at the county hospital. It was peculiar because it was like the first thing you would have noticed about him. But the tongue gave me a hint that he was having something really emergent going on, which turned out to be the case. Where he was having a collection of bleed inside his pericardial sac, which is the sac that lines the heart. And I was able to diagnose that because of the simple tests we had at Laguna Honda available to someone who had enough time to do them. In particular, I took his blood pressure, which revealed something called a pulsus paradoxicus.
Mm-hmm.
These days, nobody takes blood pressures anymore. A little machine takes them, and they can't pick up a pulsus paradoxicus, but a pulsus paradoxicus is what happens when your pericardial sac is filling up with fluid rapidly, and if that's not caught in time, it compresses the heart, and the heart stops. And because the tongue led me to do an x-ray, and the x-ray led me to take his blood pressure myself, the blood pressure led me to get the pulsus paradoxicus, within about 2 hours, I had sent him back to the county hospital, and he had 2 quarts of blood removed from his pericardial sac, which certainly saved his life. And this was not because I had any fancy tests. It was because I had the luxury of observing the patient, of taking a simple x-ray and looking at it myself, taking a blood pressure myself, and being able to put it all together.
All right. Now, you close the book by saying God's hotel was a gift. Why did you think, why isn't Laguna Honda replicated in other places in this country?
We've gone in there's a tension going on. We've gone in the opposite direction for quite a while. And I think there's a number of reasons. I guess the main thing is I don't believe that practicing medicine is delivering health care. I don't believe that nursing is delivering health care. This is a model that healthcare economists came up with to see healthcare as a commodity, as a part of the national budget that they then needed to get involved in and try and decrease its rate of growth, what we've been seeing. But as a practicing physician and as a patient, it is a relationship. Medicine is actually a relationship between the doctor and the patient. And what makes it most efficient is when you have time for that relationship to develop. And what I was really found, one of the many gifts I got, was that what economists call inefficient, so doctors and nurses having enough time to do a good job, actually is efficient, even from a healthcare economy point of view. It actually saves money, like with Lev Grins, for instance, in the sense that getting a simple x-ray and blood pressure is very, very cheap, but if I don't have the time to do it, I don't get it. And then one thing leads to another, you end up with a lot more expensive care. So God's Hotel was a gift because I'm probably one of the few people in the country who had a chance to see what that was like and what it was like to have long-term relationships with patients where I could do a really good job. So it's medicine is personal, and when it's personal, it works in the sense of getting the right diagnosis, having the patient satisfied, having the doctor satisfied, and doing it for the least amount of cost. So that was part of what I learned there.
Well, the book is now in paperback from Victoria Sweet, Dr. Sweet's book is God's Hotel. The Boston Globe says Sweet's tone in God's Hotel nicely matches her subject. Her writing has a lovely antique quality. This hospital with its chronically ill patients, crumbling buildings, and never-ending budget woes was a gift. In this beautiful and unique book, she shares that gift with us generously. And we thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
And good luck to you, Dr. Victoria Sweet, physician at San Francisco's Laguna Honda Hospital for more than 20 years and associate clinical professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. Good to visit with you early in the day in the Golden State.
Okay, bye.
Bye. And we'll be back tomorrow. J.C. Kane producing today. Thanks to you for listening, and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.